You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and welcome back to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. This week marks the historic debut of Jackie Robinson. It remains the proudest and most powerful moment in baseball, which cemented its place as a social institution on April 15, 1947, the date Jackie Robinson became a one-man freedom ride and a beacon of hope for everyone in our country in what was to become a monumental moment for sports and civil rights. And when you get right down to it, ultimately, becoming a Hall of Fame second baseman was the easy part. Our guest was a witness to history as the only Brooklyn Dodger to throw two no-hitters and held the World Series strikeout record, 14 Yankees in Game 3 in 1953 until Sandy Koufax broke it 10 years later, and pitched and won the first Dodger game in Los Angeles. He played 9 years with Jackie, who left such an impression upon him that he wrote, "What I learned from Jackie Robinson and watched the nation gradually understand the life lessons he observed." We are so very honored to welcome the hard-throwing right-hander, Carl Erskine. Great to have you on my show, Carl. Thank you. And you were a hard-throwing right-hander.
I like that. Well, somebody asked me recently, how hard did you throw? And I said, well, I threw as hard as Randy Johnson. Oh, they said you did? I said, yeah, I threw just as hard. It didn't go up there as fast, but I threw it just as hard.
That's great. When Jackie broke the color barrier, we need to be specific here, that you were still in the minor leagues. Was it a big deal on your AA club at Fort Worth, Texas?
No, it was not. It did not resonate very much down to the minor leagues. In fact, I guess history, Leonard Coppett, did you ever know Leonard?
He of course, absolutely. New York Times and a Hall of Fame writer.
Writers who actually covered Jackie. And Leonard recalled that it was a kind of a non-event in even opening day for the fact that it was such a monumental move. But you know what? It was kind of like a lot of neutrals out there said, we don't know which way it's going to go. We don't know if he can do this or not. And Ed, one of the strangest things to me is, even to this day, but back in Jackie's years trying to break down these barriers, he got very little support from the black community leadership. Now, black fans poured out big time to watch Jackie play, but the leadership of that era did not line up with Jackie. And I've always pointed that out, that it was leadership in other areas that, like Mr. Rickey, who kicked it off, but there were other the owners eventually and others, but the black leadership. I think they were just cautious and said, "This is too long a shot. We don't think he'll make it." And even the players in the Negro League said Jackie's temper will keep him from actually being successful. Well, they were all wrong because, in spite of Jackie's play, really, the most monumental thing about the experience was his self-control, how he contained that, at least in public. Rachel, his wife, said he used to come home and hammer golf balls out in their five-acre plot they had. They said he'd just take it out on the golf balls. But
sure.
But in the movie 42, depicted that, him breaking a bat in the runway out of frustration. But that was played out, actually, when Jackie got home at night.
So it was not a big deal on your minor league club in Fort Worth, but nonetheless, there was a fateful meeting between you and him on the baseball field, and he actually sought you out and encouraged you.
Listen, that was one of the most remarkable things. But what it did, it showed Jackie's character real fast. Here's a guy that finally made the first season in 47, and he was Rookie of the Year, voted by the writers, and that was a monumental thing in itself. But let me tell you, I saw a lot of good players have good first years, and it was hard to repeat it. The sophomore year, they called it, used to be the jinx year. Was this guy for real, or can he do it again? And so here's Jackie starting his second year in the spring of 48, played against us when I was at Fort Worth, Texas AA, affiliate of the Dodgers. They came there and played an exhibition game. I got to pitch. and I pitched pretty well. But after the game, a voice said, "Where's Erskine?" It was Jackie. He had come across the field to our dugout, asked for me by name, and when I stepped out and shook his hand, I didn't know Jackie. He said to me, "Young man, I hit against you twice today. You're not going to be in this league very long."
Wow.
Now, that didn't have to happen. He did not have to do that. He did do it. And it bonded me with Jackie for the rest of our playing days together, because I won 15 games by July, middle of July, at Fort Worth. They called me the Dodgers. And when I got to my locker, the first guy from the big club over to my locker was Jackie. He said, "Carl, welcome to the big leagues. I told you, you couldn't miss." Now, there were two incidents where Jackie bonded with me as a friend and as a supporter. He didn't have to do either one of those. But, boy, did that give me a lift as a kid pitcher. I was 21 years old.
Boy, man, it must have made you feel 10 feet tall. And you spent nine years with him, and he came to understand, Carl, that he would never have a problem with you because you had grown up in a mixed racially mixed neighborhood.
That's true. Yeah, there was a section of my hometown of Anderson, Indiana, called Hazelwood. And Hazelwood was a mixed neighborhood. It was principally a black neighborhood, but there were a lot of white families lived there, as we did. And I walked to school in those days. We walked to school, and I walked to school with a lot of black kids and white kids. And we had a mix of high-end families and who lived nearby, and then we had kind of a poverty area of the neighborhood. So everybody was okay in those days. We didn't have a lot of racial tension, and my best buddy was Johnny Wilson. He was Mr. Basketball in the state of Indiana in 1946, and he later played with the Globetrotters. And Johnny and I are still friends to this day, almost 80 years we've been friends.
That's great.
And when Jackie says to me, "Carl, how come you don't have a problem with this black and white thing?" I said, "Look, one of my best friends in my life is Johnny Wilson. I didn't know anything about race, and we didn't know anything about race. We were buddies, and we played through elementary school, middle school, high school, and then Johnny went on to college. I went in the Navy, but we were very close, and I used to go to the movie with Johnny, and in Anderson, Indiana, the black patrons of the theater could not sit on the main floor, so I'd always sit, and my buddies and I would sit with Johnny in the balcony.
That's good of you. That is great of you.
But we were kids. There's a song in South Pacific. It says, "You have to be carefully taught." That's about prejudice. You really have to be taught prejudice. It's not normal to grow up with somebody and be prejudiced because their skin color is different. That is not in you, but you can be taught to be prejudiced. And now we're trying to unteach that, and we're making progress. I guess we're not quite there yet, but you know, that was a monumental time in history for race relations. You know, we're still battling. Well, Jackie said to me something very insightful. I told him one day, you can't count, because a person's skin is white, he is not your enemy. There's a lot of people pulling for you, Jackie, because they know what you're doing is the right thing. Then he said to me, "Well, Carl, bigots come in all colors." Mm. Now, very insightful, because Jackie was smart, but he knew there was no answer just for one side. We had to both be on the same page. We're still working at it,
regrettably. Carl Erskine is with us on Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. And Brooklyn, Carl, was the perfect place, as it turned out, for this huge experiment.
Yeah, interesting he'd call it that, because that Mr. Rickey called it an experiment. He never referred to it in a way that he was positive it was going to work. He and himself could not predict what the culture of America would do, since it was strongly segregated all over, even in the North. And so he called it an experiment. It's interesting that you'd refer to that, because that's accurate.
After the gag order was lifted, and we can't imagine what it must have been like. You just talked about how he had to take out his frustrations on the golf balls when he came home to Rachel. But after the gag order was lifted, He got very verbal.
He did. Well, he had a pen up at him. And Mr. Rickey, you know, had a gag order on Jackie for 3 years. But after 2 years, Mr. Rickey felt like Jackie had established himself, and he forgave the third year of the gag order. But then I heard Mr. Rickey say later, he thought maybe he had made a mistake, that maybe he should have kept his original idea of 3 years. But to me, it would have still happened, because Jackie contained himself, remarkably so, with all the indignities he had. Ed, do you realize it was 7 years in the National League before the last hotel received black guests?
Wow.
That was a Chase in St. Louis. So I've always pointed out that one time I was on at the Hall of Fame function for Jackie, and we were talking about the old days and how things were, and one of the guys said, well, baseball hadn't done enough, and I objected to that. I said, baseball has done so much, society was slow. Society did not move as quickly to accept Jack and other black players as baseball did. I give baseball much credit, not a negative thought about what baseball didn't do, because at that time, it's hard for everybody to go back and know what the culture was like.
And that's a great point that you make, because this was 7 years before Brown versus Board of Education,
right,
the famous Supreme Court case. It came also before the integration of the military service, for goodness sakes.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, so Jackie, if you talk about a pioneer, he and Mr. Rickey really faced overwhelming odds. And I think that's why black leadership was reluctant to light up with Jackie. There weren't too many black writers in those days either. Or newspapers. There was a few, but Jackie basically, with Mr. Rickey's help, played it alone, and then that's why it proved to be so successful, because people in the stands saw this exciting ball player, and then when they ever heard Jackie interviewed, he was very articulate. He was very clean English. He was very smart, and handled himself extremely well. People began to say, "Well, wait a minute. This is class. This guy's class. And he's a great player. Why should we deny him?" Well, they didn't say it out loud, but in their hearts, people began to change and say, look, my golly. Now, when we go on the road, you know, the owner said it's going to hurt our attendance if you bring a black player in. Well, just the opposite. We go on the road, we packed houses every place.
Sure.
Spring training, anywhere. And listen, Ed, you can't believe this. At least two cities in the National League, Cincinnati and St. Louis, segregated the crowds the first couple of years that Jackie was in the league. The black fans could not sit in the regular stands. They sat in the pavilion. Or in Cincinnati, it was called a sun deck. And it took a while. But I always said baseball was quick to accept the fact that segregation was on its way out. But society took a lot longer.
What is there anything that comes to mind, Carl, about the worst thing that you may have witnessed or heard hurled at Jackie Robinson?
Well, he got a lot of heat. But you got to realize this. You've been around baseball enough, Ed. The dugouts are tough. It's all anything goes. So there's a lot of rough talk in baseball and try to upset the opposition. So a lot of what is considered to be racism was hard-nosed baseball, and they'd get on Jackie big time and kid him about, you know, threw the black cat on the field and all that stuff. That was trying to upset him. But here's an incident that happened in Cincinnati on a Sunday afternoon, a doubleheader. It was hot, really hot, and the trains would come in from Birmingham, Atlanta, the southern cities. The trains would come into Cincinnati. Fans just loaded, black fans would come to see Jackie play. And so during the break between the doubleheader, we were on the field 10 minutes before the second game should start, and a lot of black fans were yelling at Jackie and cheering Jackie. But one guy who was drunk, guy had had too much to drink, had been dressed fabulous at one time, but now he's very disheveled. He looked bad, and he's kind of half slobber, and he's yelling, coming down the steps toward Jackie by the dugout in Cincinnati. He said, "There's my boy Jackie. I want to see my boy Jackie." Well, Jackie took one look at this drunken guy,
and he got irate. He yelled at him. He says, go home, clean up. I'll bet your front yard looks just like you do. Get out of my sight. Well, this guy was really stopped in his tracks, and all the fans in that area heard Jackie give this guy a blast. This was an insult to Jackie for what he was trying to do, to have somebody of his race come down drunken, looking bad, yelling too loud, and Jackie was irate. But he cut the guy off quick, and so that was an incident that took place where I saw Jackie actually respond. On the field, he never did respond to insults, but that one he did. And I said, well, you know, Jackie, that was an insult to Jackie.
Carl Erskine with us on Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. I think it's fair to say that there would be no President Obama without Jackie Robinson. And I think it may also, frankly, be fair to say, Carl, there would be no Jackie Robinson without Rachel Robinson, without her support. She was really his spine as he went through these uncharted waters.
Absolutely. I've pointed that out many times because Mr. Rickey had to find a guy that could play. He had to find a guy that could control. He had to find a guy that could handle the press. But the fourth component, when he found out and met Rachel, he had to say to himself, this is a package. He's got it all. Because off the field will be hours and hours. He's on the field 5-6 hours a day. But all the other hours, he's off the field. And believe me, in those early years, when Jackie took his Dodger uniform off, put on his civvies, and went out on the street, he was just a black man in America. He was not a superstar. He was not recognized as a hero or a piece of history. He faced all the indignities that a black person in those days would face. He and Rachel could not get a house in Stamford, Connecticut. The neighborhoods objected. The neighbor objected, but that finally passed. So, yeah, I think you have to say that it took 50 years, 60 years maybe, for America to see what really happened when this young player was put on the field in a white uniform, and he had to prove, he had to catch the ball, he had to throw it, he had to outrun it, he had to hit it. He did all those things in the heat of, it's tough enough to make the majors. There's a lot of pressure to make it and stay there. But Jackie did it with the other load of being the first African-American. And so when you think about Jackie, you say he was a lone wolf, period. Nobody could help him. Mr. Rickey couldn't help him. His mother couldn't help. Rachel couldn't help him on the field. But that's what proved that he belonged. Now, here's a little feeling of my own. Jackie's in the Hall of Fame. If you go to Cooperstown, that's hallowed ground for a ball player, and you look around the plaques on the wall, there's something very symbolic about the plaques at Cooperstown. They are all the same color, and that speaks volumes to me of how baseball really should be credited for using the big stage they had and the bright lights of the Major League to break the barrier of segregation. And I think now you're starting to see that played out. And I didn't think there would ever be a name in baseball bigger than Babe Ruth. I'm not sure, but what Jackie might be a bigger name than Babe Ruth.
I don't think you'd find any argument there. He left such an impression upon you that you wrote What I Learned from Jackie Robinson. Give us a quick synopsis.
Well, what I learned from Jackie was his patience, because when I retired in baseball, my fourth child, Jimmy, was born Down syndrome. And that was a shock for a pro ball player to have a youngster with a lot of handicaps. And so now the world wasn't any more ready for people like Jimmy than they had been Jackie. And so there's a lot of learning had to be done, and a lot of fear had to be dispelled about people who looked like Jimmy, who was originally called mongoloid. That was the official medical term back in 1960 when he was born. So I lived through the life of Jimmy as he went through the stages. Finally, education was mandatory when he was 12. Then came his time in school, which before that there had been no schools for special ed kids. Then came Special Olympics. On the field, people people got to see these limited people with not good coordination, not good hand-eye coordination, not good muscle tone, performing in races and other kinds of track and field and other sports. And it sent the same message. These people should not be denied. And so there was a parallel story between Jackie's 9 years that I was privileged to play with him and living my life out with my son, Jimmy. Jimmy works at Applebee's Restaurant today. He's been there 17 years.
Wow.
He has many medals. And when Jimmy gets a gold medal in swimming or in some other event for Special Olympics, I say Jackie had something to do with it because he kicked off this momentum. I call it a momentum, and we know what that is in sports and in life. This momentum ripples to this day through society. And I think special needs people today got a little shove in the right direction because of what Jackie did.
And we should mention that you and your son Jimmy are charter members of the Special Olympics. Carl, what an honor it is for me to know you, your kindness to me unfailingly, and to come on my show. I thank you so very much to reflect upon one of the seminal moments, not just in the history of sports, but in the history of this country.
Yeah, well, you know, you don't realize it when you're going through it, but I was so privileged to play not only with the Dodgers and with that great team, but in New York. I've always been so grateful that whatever I was able to do successfully, I did it on the biggest stage in the world. And so I am indebted to... and then I had one of the most remarkable things happen. I played with a lot of Hall of Famers. I didn't make the Hall of Fame. But the safety board in Brooklyn one time named a street Erskine Street. I said, wow, now wait a minute. Who does that? Of all the great names that came down through Dodger history and Erskine Street. So let me tell you, I get up in the morning. The first thing I do is thank the good Lord for all that's happened to me and my good health through 89 years. And to be a Brooklyn Dodger, later I played in L.A., but the Brooklyn experience and the Jackie experience, you cannot imagine in my wildest dreams ever being privileged to be a piece of that.
To be a piece of that and to know that then years later when Jackie entered the Baseball Hall of Fame, that as an indication of what a modest man he was, that his Hall of Fame acceptance speech was, I believe, 2 minutes and 36 seconds long. Carl, thank you so much for your kindness. That'll do it for us on MLB.com. If you're listening on the move, thanks for the ride, and thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.